At the moment in Australia, we're going through a recession, and we haven't been through a recession in nearly 30 years. So when you're going through a recession, people start to question what they should be doing with their finances and how this will impact their investments. So on today's show, we're going to delve deep into investing through a recession and how you can successfully invest through one. We're also going to look at particular sectors that we think might perform well during the recession. Enjoy.
Everything we talk about on today's podcast is general advice only because we don't know your individual personal situation. Before you act on anything we've spoken about, you should chat to your financial advisor, and if you don't have one, feel free to reach out to us. Now, on to today's show.
Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Wealth Collective podcast. I'm Zach Masters, and today, as usual, I'm joined by Pete Pennycott from Picada and Anthony Malvazzo from AGM Advisory Group. How are we going, gents?
Feeling good, feeling fresh. The end is near in sight, so feeling good about September 28th.
What about you, Anthony? How's things?
Feeling great. Got the keys to the new pad, a lot of new amenities that I haven't seen in a building, so that was quite impressive. But getting the apartment was quite quick, but also getting deliveries of anything new that I've ordered is ready to come tomorrow. So some things in this pandemic are working quite well, like online services. So feeling good.
Yeah, and you sent me some pictures earlier, like panoramic views of the city skyline. Like, this is a penthouse living. So obviously some of us are faring better than others during a recession.
I went to the elevator up to like level 15, and I was pressing 3, no, because it's 3001, the apartment number. And I was pressing then 1, and I went to the back.
What number street are you as well? Just to give it away to the listeners out there.
I went to the concierge, and they go, no, you're on level 30. I'm like, oh, happy accident. So, got a fair view. It's quite high, but really happy.
And your beloved Lakers, they've sort of stumbled a little bit. You're just sort of a throwaway game almost, is it? It's how do you describe it?
We're in a position of throwaway games, I'll put it that way.
So you're just kicking back Lakers in 6.
I think I was listening to a few podcasts, and a few so-called experts were saying generally teams who go up 2-0, there's a bit of a lag in the first part of game three, which there was. Same thing happened with Miami. Got to do what Miami did today and just put the foot on the pedal and don't let these guys come back, because they definitely have that capability.
Yeah, they love being 3-1 down, the Nuggets.
If LeBron is that good, he will do that. I'll just add that one.
So I thought we'd talk about today before we get started. Obviously, we're into, what is it, week 1051 of lockdown here in Melbourne, or whatever it is now. So I thought last week we'd talk about movies, but I want to know what you are both reading during lockdown. So Pete, what have you been casting your eyes on during these times?
So many things. So I sort of, I think I was gonna go a book, but I don't know, go something a bit different, a different medium. So 3-2-1 from James Clear is a weekly email that I read, and it's definitely not a heavy read. It'd be sort of struggling to get to 500 words or something, but it's really hits you. And I've often shared some of the quotes that he puts in there on our Microsoft Teams internally. It gets me pumped. It's got some really good sort of thought starters for your day. And he's the author of one of the bestsellers, so Atomic Habits. Definitely worth a read. And he's really, really good. And as it suggests, it's structured as 3 ideas from him. So that's the 3. We've got 2 quotes from others, and then 1 question for you. Bang. Mic drop. Yeah. So if anyone wants to, I'll share a link to it. I really enjoy it.
That sounds interesting. What about you, Anthony?
I haven't been reading too much, but listening to a lot of podcasts, but
doesn't count.
I was listening and ours, and listening to, there's a bloke named Jeff Perlman who wrote a book about the Showtime Lakers, the Dallas Cowboys in the early 90s, and apparently he's written a ripper book about the Shaq Kobe Lakers and all the drama. So he was on speaking on a podcast today. So it sounds quite interesting and right up all our alleys. So definitely give a bit of feedback, but definitely going to order it. Cool.
Very good.
What are you reading, Zach? What's the What's on your bedside stand at the moment?
I've been reading a lot of Twitter, so I've been it's a segue. But I've been, I don't know what it is about the pandemic or what's going on, but I've been on Twitter a lot recently. It wasn't a form of social media that I used much in the past, although I've just watched The Social Dilemma too, so I've been trying to now cut that down.
Why? Tell me more about The Social Dilemma. I've been seeing a lot of this on my feed and everyone's saying to watch it.
It's just all about the manipulation that the social media companies use to lure you in. The gratification of swiping down and something new continuously popping up.
So that's their fault, is it? Where as humans, we just want sort of the people to like us.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't think that's, they were talking about that, but how your self-worth comes a lot from social media for a lot of people, especially younger users, which is, it's quite interesting. It's nothing that not really. Like, I watched it with my partner and sister, and we're all going, no, that's like, we know they do this.
Well, that's why you have every type of social media account there. DJ Zach Masters, Financial Planner, all on TikTok, Insta,
I will say Twitter is the quickest form of to receive information. Generally, that I know of, unless you guys are good.
Well, there was a segue here. Zach read something. Come on, tell us.
One of the people I follow on there is Morgan Housel. So, Pete, you and I went and listened to one of his talks quite a while.
Well played. So
he's quite funny on Twitter, but he's an expert in behavioral finance. And he has a blog, which I'll post a link to as well. It's called The Collaborative Fund. And he speaks
not a recommendation.
It's not. I don't think it's an actual fund, is it?
It is. But you need a fair bit of coin to get involved.
But he does, he's posted a lot of blogs during this time. So like the heading of one is Save Like a Pessimist, Invest Like an Optimist. And he speaks a lot about, the way or the psychology of money, which is the title of his book that he's just got out. So that's...
You're going to say read the book and I could borrow it off you and save myself 30 bucks.
Literally just come out last week.
Come on, get on to it. It's
on Amazon.
We'll do a sort of a competition or something.
I think that's going to be one that I'm going to give that a read to look at, because he states his first line is, it's not a book about what to do with your money, it's a book about what happens in your head when you try to do things with money. So that's something that I'm keen to get more of an understanding of, but I find his blog quite interesting. So I'll post a link. To that in the show notes. Going on from about us and what we've been reading, obviously here in Australia we're in a recession for the first time in nearly 30 years, which is not great, but it's on the back of what we've experienced through COVID, and that usually makes people start to question what they should be doing with their finances, and particularly how the recession will impact on their investments. So on today's show, we're going to delve deep into investing through a recession and how you can successfully invest through one go through one. We might kick off with the first question to you, Pete, is how does a recession impact your investments, or what's happened in the past?
Oh, wow. Interesting. So you'd think it'd be pretty clear cut. So recession, you think bad for businesses, so, growth slowing, businesses influence share price, therefore bad economy, recession equals bad share market performance. Would you agree with that proposition or summation?
In theory it sounds all right, but it's not necessarily what happens.
No, definitely not. And there is a lot of data suggests maybe they're not correlated. So I think I've got a blog that'll go out shortly after this, because I've basically written it in preparation for today. Having a look at the last six periods that we've had the weakest economic growth over the past 40 years, generally what's happened is the year of the downturn has been, on average, a plus 16% return. And the year after it, plus 17%. The year before it, 4%. So And they've sort of varied wildly in that. It's like quite a big dispersion of the numbers. So in terms of, seems very random, to be honest. So I would say it's a case-by-case scenario. So you've got to look company by company of the, you know, what's going to influence them, because I think different companies are impacted differently depending on what's driven the recession. So obviously some businesses at the moment are thriving. So everything that Anthony's just bought online, so like furniture, probably online, you'd have, yeah, Kogan. New TV as well.
I've seen a new Kogan package.
Yeah, white goods. So like, I think there's parts of the economy that like people are sort of, you know, are shopping online more. You know, there's going to be certain sectors of the, you know, food and beverage industry that are doing really well in this environment. But then there's pubs and clubs and, yeah, I don't know. There's different speeds. So I guess my contention would be it's not necessarily bad. There's been quite a varied, I don't know, data set of returns. And I think maybe that's because of the stimulus that comes along with it. So when you think of a recession, the share market's forward looking. So therefore, like, it's looking, going, hey, is this stimulus going to work that the governments are doing, or the monetary policy that, you know, central banks are sort of pumping into the system? That maybe could explain that phenomenon of when the recession's here, all the stuff maybe has happened in the past and it's in the rearview mirror a little bit, and the share market's looking forward through the front windscreen and going, hey, like, what's coming? Is this over? Are we closer to the end? And maybe that's sort of supporting the optimism there.
Well, that's the last time we experienced a recession in 1990 to 91. In those four quarters that the country was in recession, the ASX All Ordinaries rose by 13%. So in terms of what has happened in the past, that the being in a recession does not necessarily mean that there's a downturn in the growth of shares. What do you think, Anthony? How does a recession impact people's investments?
I'm the oldest on the podcast, and I was probably eight in the last recession. So I don't think it's something like you can look back, but I think you can only really know is when you've felt it. And the closest thing we've had is the GFC, which we really felt, but that was a little different. But what I'd say, one thing I'd add is to adjust your expectation of earnings, of what you're going to earn in your investments. But we've had a really good run over the last, you know, probably decade. Probably in for, you know, got to adjust that expected return. If you can do that and just not panic and just, as Pete said, look at different industries that are going to thrive, you can sort of, your investments can, you know, not only survive, but can really thrive. So I would say just really adjust your expected return is the best thing you can do.
Very good.
So you were sort of, how old were you at the last recession, Zach? What's the?
I wasn't here in 90 to 91.
Wait, talk to us about recessions and what do you?
No, well, that's as I said before. It's you're looking back quite a while until our last recession. And Vanguard did a in 2011. They did a study into the effect on of recession on investors and found that returns for balanced portfolios were not drastically different in recessionary periods versus expansionary periods. So the actual, I guess, what causes a recession. Does not necessarily impact the markets like you think it would. Because I don't know about both of you, but when you're talking to clients that don't necessarily look at their portfolios every day and you go, oh, here's what your portfolio balance is at the moment, they're almost shocked that it's back above pre-COVID levels or whatever. And they go, aren't we in a recession, or aren't we, you know, what's good? Like, aren't we in the middle of COVID? But as Pete mentioned, it's the market's forward-looking. So, that's something that I think can confuse people sometimes.
The market, like, I don't know, who are we quoting here, is predictably irrational. That's, yeah, there is definitely a, it feels like there's a disconnect between what you're experiencing on the ground. Like, you know, I'm not feeling like there's a huge abundance in my, like, daily routine, you know. It feels like we're in some sort of, we're in a global pandemic. That doesn't necessarily mean that you know, there's not profits to be made, or sort of there's not sort of good investments to be had. And I think you've just got to steel your nerves. And that's the key of be disciplined in your approach. And that's the behavioral psychology. So sort of going back to that book you mentioned earlier, if you can get your head right and in the game, because that's what it's all about. Like investing is it's a grind. So you need to sort of be able to sort of get through these periods that are, they suck, you know? And you need to not panic. So when the market's down, that's potentially some of the best opportunities to invest. And I think what we're highlighting here is even like thinking back to the most recent sort of market downturn, probably like last quarter of 2018 and a couple of years before that. And then, yeah, you go back to sort of over a decade ago before we had the sort of something of real significance. These opportunities don't come along very often. So you need to, you don't want to look back with regret and go, what, I should have bought more. I should have done more. I definitely shouldn't be saying I shouldn't have sold. So yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think we've Rogers on here before. Just know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
Well, speaking of that, so say people have got themselves in a position where potentially they might have lost their job or they are going to need to access their investments. What investments should be sold first if they're needing to access funds, Anthony?
I'd say you want to investigate what the business is that you're looking to hold or sell rather than just, I mean, a lot of people say, would sell a loss so they can avoid capital gains tax. But if there's a decision where you've got a company that's better off to hold yet, and then there's another company that may have some capital gains tax, but you know, it's maybe a better one to sell off. It's probably better to take that capital gains hit because you would still want to look at what the opportunities are going forward. And if there's any duds, definitely dump them. And you know, if you've got any really good industries that you're in, which I'm sure we'll talk about further, you want to look to hold on to those. But obviously you want to just assess and see this is a last resort.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And so making sure that you're never wanting to sell your growth assets at a time that's not desirable for you. But Pete, is there any specific assets that you'd look to first?
Yeah, look, my gut tells me this is why we build cash reserves into portfolios and defensive assets.
Cash buffers, rainy day funds.
Yeah, but having said that, when Anthony was talking, I'm sort of second-guessing myself a little bit, saying, well, yeah, you do have them. But if there's growth assets in the portfolio that the investment thesis is done, you've got to move them on. Like, you can't just hold them because they're growth assets and they've dropped in value.
Airline or something like that at the moment? Or is that type of...
No. I don't know. I might be buying airlines. I think the recovery is coming. So, I don't think it's as simple as I think you should have a good portfolio structure. So you should have layers in there that are the rainy day sort of breaking case of emergency assets. But you've got to look at the investment thesis. And if you've got an investment thesis that's broken or it's changed, don't be scared to cut your losses. Sometimes you're just going to go, you know what? I got it wrong. And it's not your fault. Like, you're never going to get them all right. That's part of investing. You're probably going to get, you know, if you get sort of more than 60% of them right, you're doing really well. So you've got to be prepared to walk away, and you might crystallize a capital loss, and that's not a bad thing. And you know, not many people get excited about crystallizing a capital loss, but it will come in handy at a future date when you have the massive gains to sort of offset. So don't worry, you can carry those forward.
Would this be that extra additional 20 or 30% we were talking about last week about having, you know, this is more for superannuation, you know, having 70, 80% in, you know, a good core and satellite approach and then, you know, taking some risk with the additional funds? Would you be looking to offload those?
I think it depends.
They got no opportunity, I should say. No growth.
Yeah, and I think it is. I think it's what you mentioned before. Like, it's the investment thesis. It's what's the outlook? And you want to pick up, is the risk-return trade-off right? Because sometimes the risk is high, but the return upside is also very high. So you want to make sure, I guess in an ideal scenario, you're trying to create asymmetric return opportunity where your downside's limited, but your upside is infinitely higher than that. So that's how I would approach it. But yeah, my initial thought was I was going to bat it away with a straight bat and just go, oh, of course, you'd sell those cash and term deposits you'd been sort of stockpiling just for this. But yeah, not that simple, unfortunately. You got to sort of roll up the sleeves, do your analysis again, go through your investment thesis, read your research report, and then make a decision.
Yeah, Zach, I think that's
what are you selling?
Point.
You've been sort of offloading a fair bit, sort of causing a bit of liquidity concerns on the market. So what's the...
Hold.
you'd be loading up and buying, eh? Just backing up the truck.
Yeah, buying. Yeah, I think, as you said, it depends. So obviously, if you've got growth assets that have been impacted hard or, you know, dropped off quite heavily recently and you still believe in the investment thesis that they're going to recover, then I think you should be looking towards more of your defensive assets, because that's often the reason why we hold them in the portfolios, that if times come where the market has dropped and you know you need access to funds, those are the ones you look to sell off first and let your growth ones recover. But I think you mentioned a good point.
Like, how much do you try and squirrel away? Like, is there a, for your average person who's an average investor with an average risk profile, Mr. or Mrs. Average or Miss Average or Dr. Average, well, How long? What should a buffer look like? Is there an answer to this question?
Well, if they're getting like a risk profile and things like that, but if you're a balanced investor, you're looking at 30% sitting in more defensive style assets, then 70% sitting in the growth style. It completely depends. Are you in pension phase? Are you in, you know, are you drawing down and needing income from investments? All that type of stuff.
Well, one of the things as we're talking, I think. Have a look at the transaction cost to exit the investment as well. So you want to think about what's in your pocket, because I know a lot of the funds were ramping up their buy-sell spreads, especially their sell spreads. And what that means is they're charging you more to exit the investment. So not only have you copped a haircut in return, but on the way out, they're giving you a kick in the backside as well, saying thanks for coming. Whereas I think if it's shares or if it's a term deposit, you probably got a little bit more certainty. So just make sure before you make the decision, you know, and this is where it's really important to understand what you're invested in and what all the T's and C's are, because I know with some of those funds, they got in excess of 2%. Yeah. That's a lot of money. Like when 2% sort of, haircut on the way out. Gosh, I wish I could get a haircut.
Just get the shame to it.
Nah, it's a lot I'm easier. Hanging on to it. Hey, I don't know how many more years I've got this for. I'm definitely not saving it. Might not come back. It'll be shocked.
JS Health, hair and energy vitamins, not applied. Anyone struggling with hair growth out there?
I'm looking at myself in the Zoom call. My receding hairline's getting pretty bad. what were we talking about? Share.
So I'll send you a link after this.
Yeah, so I don't know, like transaction costs are a big one. And that's probably why you don't go selling lumpy assets. So, yeah, would I choose to be selling an investment property or something of that nature now? Well, good luck getting someone through the property to have a look at it. But yeah, I'd say it'd be more liquid assets. Yeah, and it's the things that have probably the least upside that, you know, you've got the lowest conviction on.
Yeah. Now, another point that a lot of people talk about or discuss during times like this is currency hedging. So how that can potentially impact the portfolio during a recession. So as the investment guru in here, Pete, do you maybe want to run us through, I guess, what impacts currency hedging can have on a portfolio during a recession?
Massive. Currency hedging is as big a decision as what asset are you choosing or what asset class. Currency can move around wildly. We've seen that during even this last 6 months. So where it was giving you some cushioning, and yeah, I think it was William Shakespeare was could be quoted as to hedge or not to hedge. That is the question. Well, maybe not. Maybe I've heard that somewhere else. But I think, so in thinking for local investors, the Aussie dollar, how is that tracking? And probably the most common one we see, because most of the share market is US. So you look at the Aussie dollar versus the US dollar, we've moved I think in excess of 20 cents in terms of the fluctuation in the last few months. So you think about what that has an impact to your returns. that's potentially impacted your returns by in excess of 20% if you've got it wrong. So I do think you need to take it into account, but I think it's really, really, really hard to predict currency. So I think most economists out there believe that things almost revert to the mean over long investment cycles. So the choice to sort of hedge or not hedge, it's another proactive investment decision. And I think that's sometimes why it makes sense to employ a high quality manager that actually has an active currency overlay and get them to do it for you, because you doing it is probably going to be, unless you're a sort of an FX expert of any, or sort of have that sort of insight into the economic movements, because if you get it wrong, it could sort of erode your returns quite significantly. Or you might just choose to go hedged or unhedged and then let it roll and go, you know what, I think having currency exposure is a good diversifier, because it does give you another element of return. And it depends. Like we switched part of our sort of currency strategy when the Aussie dollar sort of got close to bottom in March. We sort of flicked the switch and sort of took a hedge position, because we just felt like this was so much lower than the long-term average. I wasn't making a call on is it good this week or this month. It was a long-term going, I'm happy to hold this position for years. And I think in the long run, this is a reasonable entry point. And that's how I would look at it. I'm not a trader, I'm not a currency expert. Like, we take on feedback from sort of our research partners to go, hey, this seems low historically. And if you're happy to hold for the long term, that might be a reasonable entry point. And I think, you know, what was it, 50? It was in the 50s, you know. So, and I still have sort of fond memories when I was traveling in the States and it was parity. And I was, you know, felt like a rock star. I was amazing. Couldn't even imagine going over there 58 cents. I wouldn't even be able to afford a hotel.
What about you, Anthony? Do you have anything else to add on the currency hedging during the recession?
An analogy. I think the last one was taken quite well a few weeks ago. If you look at the Houston Rockets this year, they really went the three ball, and then they were looking to trade out Capella, and they tried to put a hedge in with Russell Westbrook, who's completely the opposite. So, and it blew up in their face, which what that just says, the whole game plan was flawed. But that's just the risk of hedging. So it can work out, but it needs to be the right hedge and the right game plan to begin with. I might just leave that. I thought another NBA analogy might be required.
Sorry for everyone who doesn't watch any basketball that listens to this podcast.
Some people just literally thought you were speaking another language there. What's a Capella? What's a Westbrook? What podcast am I listening to? Is this Bill Simmons or is this the Wealth Collective?
It will limit risk in a portfolio, getting back to the investment talk. But again, it's only going to mitigate risk. But as Pete said, it really depends on a number of factors.
Very good. So I think the last point we might touch on in this topic is what sectors or investment trends you think can perform well during this recession. So we might go back to you, Anthony, and what ones do you think can perform well?
We've mentioned it a number of times, with the world becoming more digitized, AI, no brainer there. Again, it's quite tough to pick a winner. But as Pete alluded to last, maybe traditional asset classes aren't the way to go going forward. There's going to be a lot of other opportunities, but airlines were brought up. If we can't fly overseas until 2023, I'm not sure Qantas is a great start.
Hang on, what?
Buy the dip.
Excuse me, when can't we fly until 2023?
It's been reported 2023 will be the next on overseas flight.
What news outlet is this?
One of the major ones. I think it was
clickbait headline. Clickbait.
Hang on a second. What?
Okay.
Wow. You floored me.
Okay, Pete, answer me this. We can't go outside 5Ks right now, and that's probably going to continue for another 4 months.
That's only in Victoria.
We won't be able to leave Victoria. And the cases are going to blow up. This is not a wave, a second wave of corona. Apparently, it's a wave. So it's going to be with us. So there's going to be it's going to be problematic going forward. England's looking, the UK's going back to full lockdown.
I've got confidence Boris has got it sorted. So he seems he's on. He's got his finger on the pulse.
50,000 a day expected. Personally, I think airlines is probably something to stay away, but obviously you think different. Outside of that, it's going to be tough. I mean, you just look at the industries that are growing, and AI is probably one, and it's probably an easy one there. How about yourselves?
What about you, Pete?
Oh, I thought I was waiting for your insights here.
Oh, yeah, I can go.
I wanted one.
Okay, you can end up.
I had my pen and paper ready.
It's all right. I'll go because you can. That way you can get in your final point mixed with your last point, a little bit extra. a little while ago, my dad used to work for the reject shop, and he always said during periods like a recession or periods where people were struggling, like discount retailers and different things along those lines, their sales used to skyrocket. They outperform their normal benchmarks quite heavily during times like that. So whether people look for uncertainty, in uncertain times, they start to go.
What types of businesses would fall into that bucket? Like the reject shop, obviously, is one. But
yeah, and they've got the different types. Even I've been seeing a lot of online retailers and things like that. They're not necessarily fully discount ones, but are seem to have sales on quite a lot, like your Kogan's and your different ones like that, where people are going, I find this is a cheaper alternative, or it's a marketplace where I can get different prices on a lot of the same items and things like that.
You're trying to just see what behavior changes, aren't you? Because you're sort of one of the ones which sort of sticks with me as a lesson from an old investing mentor a few years ago was people tend to hang onto their cars longer. So don't change them over. So, your automotive repairs and your car part places. And I'm not a car person by any stretch, I can see how that might make sense. So
Tesla sales go up. Longer.
And do they go and replace their own wiper blades? Do they want to sort of get the dealer to do it for $150 or something? And they'll go buy the $5 wiper blades and watch a Google tutorial about how to fix it. Not that I've done that myself, but apparently.
That's I've read that, Tesla sales and things like that go up during a recession. Because people start to look for a Hail Mary.
Yeah, some young person won it last week. Which is
20-year-old in Sydney, 60 mil. What about you, Pete? What areas or what investments are you, trends are you seeing?
I was going to say something that Anthony sort of said it's not going to be any good. So we'll pick another one that might be
buy the dip.
Nah, you can't always buy the dip. So it's a fallacy. It might be sort of catching a falling knife and getting it right in your hand. I like the one of online retail, but specialty retail. I think it's all been big, like Amazon. It's your JB Hi-Fi, the Alibaba, in Latin America, Mercado Libre. So these big ones, eBay. I think the next wave is the smaller online retailer where they can customize the experience, customize the product, and it lands too quickly. Because I think what's going to improve is the infrastructure to get stuff. Like Anthony mentioned before, order something, it's at your house the next day.
That was mydeal.com, by the way.
mydeal.com.au.
Yeah,
so I think like that.
90%.
As long as Australia Post doesn't touch it along the way.
Yeah, well, having said that, I'm waiting for some customs sort of luggage tags to arrive from overseas, and they've been a long time coming. But look, what I'm thinking is things like Etsy. There you go. These are customizable, they're personalized, but you're still able to do it online. So, the comfort of your home, we're all comfortable with shopping online now because we've done it. Doesn't matter what age group you are. For those sort of businesses and companies that are that's their niche and they own it. So, even ones I've been sort of ordering. So, Rhiannon's had a birthday recently, so sort of got some nice. I think they're called petrified or dried flowers or something. They last forever. Fantastic. But they arrive hand delivered to the house, looking perfect, bang, delivered on the morning of her birthday. So I look like a superstar. Why would I not use that company again when they've done so well? It's sort of making me look fantastic, even though I only ordered it a couple of days beforehand.
Rhiannon doesn't listen to the podcast, does she?
No, she hates listening to the podcast in the background while we're talking. I think there's a lot of these ones globally popping up as well, where you go, look, all they do is sell pet products. A lot more people have bought pets, and I see it all the time, and I hope everyone loves their pets after the pandemic's over. But people love their pets, so they're going to go, I'm going to keep ordering from this company. This company creates great experiences. Like, you know, they tailor it. They're sort of monitoring what I've bought in the past, and then they're offering me other products going, oh, we know you've got this type of breed of dog. Here's something you should try. And the one that I'm thinking of overseas is like Chewy. Amazing. Like, you go on there, you mentioned about Twitter and their Facebook page. The feedback they get on there is unbelievable. It's just, yeah, everyone's posting photos and stuff because it's, I think you're starting to create this community. Like, people want to like be seen with products and be like, what's it called when you put it on an Insta story?
That seems to be popular. Like a little, reposting and
yeah, repost
reels.
Like, everyone loves that and tagging on that. So, I think that's the next wave. And there's a lot of smaller upstart companies that will dominate in this new world. And I think it's becoming more affordable to set up online stores. And even the old school thing of like the amount of packages we receive in this house that have handwritten notes in it saying thanks and I see it on food as well. I think that's the thing to have a look at. Like, companies that, you know what their point of difference from Amazon is? It's personal. It's a personal touch. They understand you better than the giant, massive Death Star retailer. And no, I love Amazon. So I'm sort of giving a smack to Jeff and co.
Do you have something you want to add in there, Anthony?
Yeah, one thing that I've noticed that just a lot of, you know, people that wouldn't listen to what we're doing now, podcasting. I think that's just going to balloon even further. Everyone's all of a sudden listening
to Spotify.
But definitely podcasting is going to become bigger. Everyone, no one's going to listen to live radio anymore. So everyone, but still want to listen to that show or shows like this, the Wealth Collective or NBA, finance, footy, whatever. Podcasting is getting into every industry. And even younger people, these, what do they call them? The influencers, they're starting to do podcasting. It's just, it's really going to, I feel that's going to be an industry that just grows and grows.
I think it's the best way to get information because you can do it at your own speed. We're all got headphones in most of the time because we hate the thought of someone like having a conversation with us that we don't know while we're, you know, dreaming of commuting to work again. I've definitely noticed a correlation. So like in our production meeting, Zach, you know, shows us how the numbers are tracking for the Wealth Collective podcast and sort of, you know, bottom left to top right, sort of upward trending. Also, Spotify share price, upward trending, same trajectory. So, the trend is your friend, apparently. So, I'm just saying.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up. Does either of you have any other points you wanted to leave about investing through a recession?
Be bold. Don't have regrets when you look back because these are opportunities that do not happen often. But, you know, have a steady hand, I'd say, and don't be stupid. Don't just think because it's gone down, it's necessarily going to go up. That is a absolute investing myth.
Just do your research and stay ahead of the game. Just try and keep ahead of the game.
Very good. So we might move on to the mailbag question quickly because I know we've gone a little bit over our normal episode length. Yeah, we're well over half an hour.
Get a counter on my screen.
So we've got a question in from Tim this week who said, I've got a defined benefit, but I'm worried about leaving behind an inheritance to my children as the defined benefit will go to my wife upon passing, but finishes up upon her passing. I have the ability to withdraw it as a lump sum. Should I do that now and invest it through retirement or should I keep the defined benefit?
Over to you, Anthony.
Go, Anthony.
Over to you, Zach, actually. Let Zach do it.
Hey, Zach, do you want to...
It depends. I've had the benefit of a quick chat with Tim because I've spoken to him about it, and it turns out that
hang on, you've cheated. This is you already know this.
This is the main. Yeah,
I haven't read the question yet, and you've been pondering on this for ages.
Well, one of the main points I think you need to look, like one of the big things in retirement is if you can get certainty of income on above or at what your expenses are, I think that's a massive benefit. Obviously, with a defined benefit, you take the risk that you pass away prematurely and your spouse does as well, then potentially you're worse off. But having something that's able to, regardless of what the investment markets are doing, that's able to produce you an income at the same amount each year, I think that's quite a big benefit. And in this case, it looked as though the defined benefit would likely cover most of his lifestyle and, you know, living expenses. So that was quite a big benefit that I think you need to look at. And I think a lot of the time with inheritances, people become, you know, worried about not passing enough down rather than making themselves as financially successful as possible. And they've still got, like, potentially you've still got a family home, you've got the other assets as well, outside of the defined benefit, which you will pass down. So that's something that I think you need to think about. But yeah, the ability to have a guaranteed income each month that comes in that covers your expenses, I think that's a massive plus for you guys.
Did you want to go, Pete, or you want me to go?
No, go for it.
I think the only time I've been in a situation where a client didn't go ahead with the defined benefit was when health was a big issue. It was terminal, and the spouse was also not well. I think that's a situation where, you know, locking something up, we're only going to get a symbol. You know, you're going to lose out. You're definitely going to lose out. That's not a situation. But as Zach said, if you've got a guaranteed income and it does, you know, cover your living costs, that's something, that's a big thing to give up with, you know, such uncertainty for over 30, 40 years or how long the life expectancy is. But also if it's a lower amount, that's when you got to just, you know, if you're only getting, you know, something that's going to cover half your living costs, that's something really to consider as well. But also, if you're going to go, what would you do if you did that, you know, exit out of it? What would be the investment strategy then? And then just sort of, you know, determine that there. But definitely the first sort of path you want to take is to look at the guaranteed income stream. Do you agree, Pete?
Yeah, I do in most cases. I think depends on who's guaranteeing the defined benefit plan. Like, what is the solvency of this company? So I think one of the recent ones where it's been questioned, where they're sort of changing the rule book, is ExxonMobil at the moment. They're going through some significant changes. So a guarantee is only as good as the person guaranteeing it. It's like, you know, Joe Bloggs down the street guarantees you he's going to give you $1 million next week. Well, okay, great. It's a good guarantee. It's a guarantee. Well, how much money does Joe Bloggs have, and how reliable is he on his word? So I think the main thing, what there's oversight by APRA. These things are generally well funded, and, you know, these are not normal sets of circumstances. But I think what we're finding is people are living longer, so longevity is a problem. So there's more people draining these defined benefit schemes. So it's quite common that a top up's required by the company. If the company is not in a good financial position, can that continue to be funded? And who's
low interest rate environment?
Yeah, so there's this. They can't swing for the fences with these assets. Like, they need to invest in a lot of defensive assets. But if returns keep trending lower, there is this risk that sort of looms that is it solvent? Are they able to do this? Because if life expectancy keeps going out now, I think that's part of the reason why these defined benefit plans don't exist in like, they're not sort of widely held across society. So but if you had complete certainty of the defined benefit plan, I don't know, it's worth a hell of a lot. But you got to add a big premium to that. Like, you know, you're going to sleep better at night knowing, rain, hail, or shine, this is coming in. And going back to Anthony and the NBA, something you'll understand, the mailman always delivers, just not on Sunday. But
very good, very good. Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up for today's episode. So as always, if you've got any questions, email us at connect@picada.com.au. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thanks, gents.
Thank you.